There are a variety of problems, many of them quite serious, that wouldn't seem to have much to do with one another, and yet they do. Problems like this one.
Authorities say there's an avalanche of cocaine crossing our borders.
Problems like this one.
I placed $75,000 in this briefcase for one Congressman Eric Kishoygin of the 4th District.
Like this one.
You're providing this vehicle that's facilitating tax evasion.
And even this one.
It looked like a commando operation. The thieves were lowered on ropes onto the roof of the building.
What do high-stakes robbery, tax evasion, bribery, and drug dealing all have in common? One word. Cash.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If you go back 40 years to 1976, there was roughly $80 billion of U.S. paper currency in circulation. Today, there's roughly $1.5 trillion in circulation, nearly 20 times as much, which, on the one hand, would seem to make sense. Inflation, right? But on the other hand, why is there so much cash floating around when we've got so many other ways to pay for things? And here's what's even stranger. Back in 1976, about 25% of U.S. cash was in $100 bills, and now around 80%.
How much is that? The average person would be having to carry around 35 or 36 of them in their house or in their wallet. This is for every man, woman, and child.
That's Ken Rogoff.
I'm a professor of economics at Harvard University. I work on what's called international macroeconomics, involves interest rates, exchange rates, trade imbalances.
The sexy stuff, in other words, you work on.
Not all of it.
So if Rogoff is right, the question is, do you have $35 or $3,600 bills in your house or wallet? And even with inflation, how did $100 bills go from 25% of U.S. cash in circulation to 80%? And is that a good thing? Or, well, you probably already figured out where I'm going with this. Is it a bad thing? Let me introduce you to James S. Henry.
I'm an economist, attorney, and investigative journalist.
Also,
senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network and a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Development and a global justice fellow at Yale.
When Henry was in grad school in the 1970s, he went home to Minnesota for Christmas to visit his folks. His father was a CPA.
And he stumbled across this unusual fact that there was more than one $100 bill outstanding for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And he said, I've never seen a $100 bill. I don't think anybody uses them for retail purchases. We have credit cards. We have checks. You know, where the heck are these things?
Henry began a long odyssey of looking into this mystery. At one point, he got hold of some data from the Federal Reserve. One duty of the Fed's 12 regional banks is to supply commercial banks with cash. Henry could see which regional banks had greater demand for big bills.
There are some regions, like the Midwest, that had almost no demand for $100 bills.
But Henry and his colleagues discovered a big difference in other places.
What we found was a really interesting pattern involving border states like Florida, California, and Texas that were basically, it turned out, heavily involved in drug trafficking.
It happens frequently, and it happened again last night. A cocaine arrest, this one at Miami International Airport.
Most cocaine comes from South America, frequently hidden in ingenious ways. For example, tucked inside chocolate bars or diluted in bottles of sherry.
Americans had developed a hearty appetite for illicit drugs, many of which were imported. Most of the drugs that were imported from South America entered through Miami. By the late 1970s, the Drug Enforcement Agency declared that Florida's biggest industry was the illegal drug trade, worth roughly $10 billion a year. James Henry, curious about all those $100 bills, went to Miami himself and interviewed law enforcement officials.
And they're saying, well, this really makes sense when you think about it from our standpoint. The stuff is being sold on the street for tens and twenties. They bring it down here and they convert it and pay it into the banking system and get larger bills that are easier to ship out. So it was providing the monetary side of the real drug traffic economy, which was just exploding during that last 3-4 years of the 70s.
By now, Henry had come to believe that most big bills in circulation were being used for one of two purposes. He had published an article in the Washington Monthly explaining his theory. The first, he wrote, is profit-motivated crime. Illegal gambling, drugs, prostitution, loan sharking, the fencing of stolen merchandise, etc. The second is tax evasion, by people who arrange to receive cash income and don't report it. And Henry proposed that the U.S. government should do something about this.
Well, I thought it unseemly and probably as a matter of public policy undesirable for the U.S. to basically passively be facilitating this kind of very convenient form of underground activity.
He named his proposal calling in the big bills. It would devalue existing $100 bills, essentially forcing people with big stockpiles to turn them in for new bills. Henry's idea made a splash in the media and academia, he says, and it contributed to new reporting requirements for large cash transfers, but it was never seriously considered by policymakers. They just kept printing away.
Demand for $100 bills in the 70s grew at more than 15% per year in real terms.
And it hasn't stopped since.
The growth in cash, how much the government's issued, it's just booming.
That's Ken Rogoff again.
They don't know where it goes. They don't know who's using it, but they know it's really popular and they like the money.
They like the money, Rogoff says, because they make money by making money.
Oh, absolutely. There's a big profit incentive. So let's understand central banks are owned by the Treasury, and it's a little bit difficult to say who's getting the money. But in the United States, you know, we've been earning on the order of 0.4% of GDP. It's about $70 billion a year by printing this stuff. And the Treasury Secretary is very happy about it. The Federal Reserve, it makes them look like a big profit center. That's a little bit of an illusion because you're providing this vehicle that's facilitating tax evasion, which is an order of magnitude larger, but say 10 times larger if you did state plus federal. And it's also aiding and abetting crime. And if you took into account the human costs, the enforcement costs, the tax loss, I argue that these easily swamp these visible profits.
I mean, the way you describe the government's role and the government's attitude and their profit incentives, you make them sound like a drug dealer, like we're manufacturing this stuff, right? We have our own meth lab. It's called Treasury. And we're distributing it kind of to whoever wants it, no questions asked. And then they take it and do with it whatever they want to do with it. They use it. They sell it. They give it to someone in a suitcase in exchange for something. And we have absolutely no idea what happens to it once it leaves our doorstep. And that doesn't sound like very judicious behavior for a federal government like ours when you put it like that. Am I interpreting your words more darkly than you mean them to sound, or is it really that bad? Is the government that complicit?
Well, I try to seem sober, but yes, I basically, you know, agree with the tone that you put in that. That's why I refer to it as reverse money laundering, because money laundering, you're taking dirty money that you might have gotten through a crime and trying to make it so you can spend it without being noticed and make it clean. And of course, the central banks take clean money, these $100 bills, push it out into they don't know where. And of course, it ends up as dirty money.
That is just one of several reasons Ken Rogoff believes that cash should be, well, nearly eliminated. Here's how he puts it in his book, The Curse of Cash. Cash lies at the heart of some of today's most intractable public finance and monetary problems, and getting rid of most cash could help more than you might think.
It just plays a huge role in crime. There are lots of ways to conduct crime. You can use uncut diamonds, you can use gold coins, you can use cryptocurrencies, but you just can't scale them the same way simply because these other things are not that easy to go spend in the economy. And yeah, crime would go on. People would do stuff. You don't have to cut crime by 50% to make this a good idea. If you think of what we spend on cutting crime 5% is a big deal. And this is not a very complicated way to do it. Cash plays a very, very big role in just a whole range of crime. Drugs, bribes, extortion, human trafficking, money laundering.
Another problem, exacerbated by cash, tax evasion. The U.S. tax gap, that's the difference between what's owed and what's paid in, was, as of 2006, around $400 billion, or 2.7% of GDP. Every time someone gets paid in cash, whether they're a drug dealer or a plumber or a restaurateur, that makes it a lot easier to avoid paying tax.
It's not like getting rid of big bills is suddenly going to make tax evasion go away. But the numbers are just staggering for the costs of these things. And if you could cut tax evasion by, say, 10 to 15% and cut crime even by a few percent, I argue that would be a big win over the purported gains from these mass quantities of cash that are around.
Rogoff is not arguing for a totally cashless society.
I call it the less cash society.
If you accept that cash promotes tax evasion, illegal immigration, all sorts of crime, you might think that Rogoff's argument is not at all controversial. You might think no one besides drug dealers and dictators, maybe government treasuries, would object, because cash, as wonderful an invention as it was and as well as it served us for centuries, has come to feel a bit antediluvian in the 21st century, and you'd think we'd be eager to see it go. Alas, if that's what you thought, you would be wrong. There are a lot of people who see cash very differently than a Harvard economist like Ken Rogoff. On Amazon.com, for instance, his book has a disproportionate share of one-star reviews. Here's a typical one. Cold hard cash may allow criminals anonymity, but it also affords honest, law-abiding people the freedom to live their lives outside a shaky and corrupt bank system. Beyond that, why should honest people not be allowed anonymity? The day we go cashless, the government will be able to track your every move. This is nothing more than sheer propaganda to enable the money powers to steal from the little people. Ken Rogoff is not blind to this concern.
I think the privacy issue is a huge one. And my view is that there's a trade-off, and you have to sort of draw the line between, you don't want to allow big, repeated, anonymous, wholesale transactions by big operations, by big tax evaders. Yeah, if somebody wants to do something for a few hundred dollars, you totally want to allow that.
This is a concern that when I first wrote my piece back in the 1970s, I really didn't really have.
James Henry again.
It was a period in which pervasive government spying wasn't such an issue. I guess I have more sympathy now with the idea that many citizens might feel about, stay out of our affairs. We want to have some large bills on hand that no one knows we have. I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing to have some financial privacy.
If you are the kind of person who objects to a less cash society on privacy grounds, you will almost certainly hate Rogoff's following argument. He thinks one of the most important reasons to get rid of most cash is that it would give central bankers more control over the economy.
So right now, interest rates are stuck at zero, and there are certainly a lot of economists and central bank researchers who've argued that at the peak of the Great Recession, it would have been nice if they could have cut interest rates even more than they did, below zero, maybe even to minus 2 to 4%, to try to just jumpstart the economy, keep inflation up, keep employment up. That's not something you do lightly. It's not something you want to do. But if you have growth collapsing, if you have inflation collapsing, in principle, it would work. Why didn't they do it? Why didn't they even really consider it? They didn't do it because there's paper currency, and central bankers rightly worry that if they set interest rates really negative and people thought they would sit there for a long time, there'd be this mad dash into cash, which would, first of all, eviscerate the policy because interest rates wouldn't go down. And second of all, you know, create all kinds of chaos with that much cash floating around.
Rogoff's plan for a less cash society would need to be carried out gradually and thoughtfully.
So the specifics of my plan are to first phase out large notes over a fairly long period. We'd start with hundreds, then 50s, then 20s. Think of that taking place over 10 to 15 years. I would leave the smaller notes around just because we're still far from solving perfectly some of the problems about what to do in a storm, privacy, small transactions. You want to send Junior to the store for candy and don't want to give them, you know, a credit card. I would eventually also phase those out.
Rogoff would eventually replace small bills with coins, again, making it harder to carry large amounts of cash.
You know, the whole idea is to make it hard to carry huge amounts around, to have huge transactions. And a third principle is you absolutely have to provide for financial inclusion to make sure the poor, which are particularly reliant on small bills and cash, have other means to do things. Give people subsidized debit cards. They've done this in other countries. I think it's actually rather easy and relatively inexpensive to introduce, someday even smartphones. A lot of the objections, I think, if people think it out, maybe they'll feel they're a little less compelling. Everyone feels they have a very intimate relationship with cash, and they sort of have an idea off the top of their head. You know, what if we have a storm and there's no power? How would I pay? You know, what if I don't want my spouse to know that I bought something for her? You know, that kind of thing. Everybody has sort of a question off the top of their head. And I mean, if you think about it a little more, these can be answered, but it's something that's very intimate. I think that's one of the reasons you have to move slowly.
At the moment, Rogoff's dream still feels a bit like a dream, at least in America. But elsewhere, forget about a less cash society. They are rushing headlong toward getting rid of cash entirely. So, coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we check in with Sweden.
So it's increasingly became more and more difficult to access cash.
And we check in with India.
India is actually in a unique place to leapfrog on payment technology and make the economy depend less and less on cash.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I'm Stephen Dubner. This is Freakonomics Radio. If you were not paying attention to the news coming out of Sweden in September of 2009, you might have missed this story.
A group of very well-organized criminals had decided to rob a cash depot in the southern parts of Stockholm.
That's Nicholas Arvidsson.
I'm an associate professor at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden.
A cash depot, Arvidsson tells us, warehouses and distributes Sweden's currency, kroner, or in English, crowns.
So this was a place where there was a lot of cash.
The thieves were ambitious.
They had stolen a helicopter.
They were good planners. On the roads leading to the cash depot, they laid down spikes to prevent police cars from reaching them.
And they also put fake bombs on the police helicopters.
They were foiled when they discovered a package reportedly labeled bomb lying next to the aircraft they wanted to use.
The police actually were scared to use them.
They flew their stolen helicopter to the cash depot just before dawn on the 23rd of September.
It looked like a commando operation. The thieves were lowered on ropes onto the roof of the building.
And they drilled a hole through the roof, entered the building.
Police were alerted after several explosions were heard coming from the security.
They used explosives and chainsaws to get into the safes.
They got around 40 million Swedish crowns, about 5 million US dollars.
They loaded the money into the helicopter.
What they did then was they dropped the money in a lake. So a boat picked up the money. Then they landed the helicopter away from that area.
And this is where the stolen getaway helicopter landed, in fields in the northern suburbs of the capital.
And just left it there and drove away with runaway cars.
Most of the thieves got away.
Some of them were caught, but the money was not recovered. And the people they caught, of course, got into jail, but they didn't say where the money is. So the money's still gone.
Arvidsson says the heist had a profound effect.
This really took Sweden with a big surprise, I think. To us, it was the things we had seen in Hollywood movies, but never thought could happen in reality.
It was also the most dramatic of a string of armed robberies in Sweden. Not just banks, but retail shops, even city buses were being robbed. The lure of cash was obvious.
And this intensified this debate. This made many people say that enough is enough. We can't have cash anymore. It's not safe.
Arvidsson has spent years studying payment systems in general, and particularly how to get rid of cash. When it comes to money, Sweden has been on the leading edge for a long time.
The Swedish Central Bank in the 1660s was one of the first central banks that actually issued paper money by the state.
In the 1970s, Swedish banks were an early adopter of information technology, which changed how companies paid workers.
So they talked with the industry and decided together that wages and salaries were to be paid directly into bank accounts instead of being paid out in cash.
By the 1990s, with debit and credit cards so prominent, Swedish banks began to phase out checks.
The banks issued fees on checks, and that basically killed the whole check service in Sweden. So today we don't use checks at all.
Arvidsson says Sweden's progress on electronic payments had stalled by the mid-2000s, especially after the global financial crisis. Then came the wave of robberies.
This caused a lot of trauma for the people working in these buses, in these retail shops and in these banks. So the union started to think that, well, should our employees really have to suffer this?
Swedish unions began to campaign for currency reform.
They started something they called Cash Free Now. They stationed people next to ATMs, for instance, in Sweden, and started to talk with normal people that just wanted to withdraw cash from the ATMs, started to inform them about the risks of cash and so on.
The Swedish government, meanwhile, decided to phase out the 1,000-krona bill, its largest denomination, is worth a bit more than $100. But Arvidsson says the private sector has been more aggressive. Banks, for instance, have been shutting down ATMs.
So it's increasingly became more and more difficult to access cash.
The banks also created a mobile payment service called Swish. It's a smartphone app that lets you transfer money almost instantly.
So the money is actually transferred within 2 seconds from one bank account to another.
This feature, known as real-time clearing, is vital to replacing cash. We've been talking about various disadvantages to cash relative to electronic payments, but think of its advantages. Cash is portable, it's fungible, it's instant. Niklas Arvidsson says that Swish has replicated these advantages so well that cash isn't as necessary.
One way of measuring how much cash we use is cash in transit in relation to GDP. And for Sweden, that number is less than 2%. I think the corresponding figure for the US is about 7%. And for the EU, euro area, is even higher, around 9% or so. And it could actually be that these numbers are a little bit old. I think because the decrease of the use of cash is so quick now, just the last year, the amount of cash in circulation decreased by over 10%. So the decrease is very rapid now.
So rapid, in fact, that Arvidsson believes Sweden, the first European country to issue government-backed paper currency, may be the first one to get rid of it.
I believe that in 5 years, or somewhere around that, it's possible. It might even be likely that we are in a situation where the use of cash is so little that it's sort of practically a cash-free economy.
In its push to minimize cash, Sweden is hardly an outlier. The rest of Scandinavia is moving in the same direction for all the reasons we've been hearing, including Ken Rogoff's and James Henry's arguments that cash is much more useful to criminals than anyone else. It's also happening elsewhere in Europe, France and the Netherlands in particular, and all over Asia. Singapore's central bank is pushing commercial banks to do away with cash. What all these countries have in common is a long and robust history of electronic payment technology, which certainly helps if your goal is to phase out cash. They're all also relatively rich and relatively small. But what about a country without that history? A country that happens to be very large and that has a lot of poor people.
India is actually in a unique place to leapfrog on payment technology and make the economy depend less and less on cash.
And that is...
Nandan Nilekani speaking.
Nilekani is an Indian billionaire who co-founded the IT consulting firm Infosys. His 2008 book, Imagining India, offered a roadmap for India to thrive in the 21st century. Nilekani was asked by then Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to set up a modern identification system for Indian citizens, along the lines of how the U.S. introduced the Social Security card back in the 1930s.
They needed an ID for everyone to sort of keep track of their contributions and their entitlements through their lifetime. And fundamentally, India was at a similar point where millions of people were getting benefits, but because they didn't have a strong ID system, there's a lot of wastage, leakage, and corruption.
The new system, called Aadhaar, led to 1 billion people getting an official ID in just over 5 years. But it's more than just a social security card. It's a technology platform with biometric identification that, among other things, helps individuals and institutions seamlessly transfer money to one another.
So when government gives any kind of subsidies or entitlements, they can electronically route it into the bank account of the recipient using Aadhaar. And today, that system has done over 1 billion transactions already in the last 3 years. Now, that's the first step, because once money comes into somebody's bank account, it's already sitting in an electronic account, and therefore it is cashless. Now, if there's a way that we can get them to retain their money in their accounts and transact cashlessly, then automatically the route to the cashless society starts.
Nilekani worked on this project as an advisor to the National Payment Corporation of India. It's a nonprofit set up by Indian banks to modernize their payment system.
They have launched many payment systems for retail payments, ATMs, mobile payments, and all that.
Next, they created the Unified Payment Interface, or UPI. UPI was hoping to replicate the success of M-Pesa. That's a phone-based system that made Kenya a world leader in mobile payments.
UPI is a way to leapfrog on mobile payments. And it is designed for instant debit and instant credit, which means that, let's say that I'm paying a merchant 5,000 rupees at a shop. I say, pay 5,000, and automatically my account gets debited in real time. And the merchant's account gets credited in real time. Now, this, by the way, this system, such a system doesn't really exist, for example, in the US. It's a big deal.
It's a big deal, Nilekani says, because it's fast, secure, flexible, and cheap. And whereas M-Pesa is limited to cell phones and controlled by one company, Vodafone, UPI is an open system.
We are building a system for every bank to talk to every other bank, do an instant payment, instant debit and credit with very low transaction cost. This system doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Sending and receiving money from your mobile phone will be as simple as sending or receiving a text message or an email. And we think that with India's growing smartphones, already India has 200 million smartphones, expected to grow to 700 million, 1 billion people with the Aadhaar number, and the government pushing everyone to get a bank account as part of financial inclusion, all these things are coming together to create a sort of a tipping point, which we think will lead to a dramatic surge in cashless transactions.
India has a massive underground economy, by some estimates as big as $500 billion a year.
Once you have a digital trail, obviously it's far more difficult to do money laundering or avoid paying taxes. But I think the biggest thing in favor of going cashless is that now my digital behavior of payments, I can now harness to get a loan. And I think that's a huge thing. You know, typically loans are given against assets. And these people don't have any assets. But once you have their payment history, then you can give loans against the cash flow because you know that they have a certain earning capacity and therefore you know that they can pay the loan back. So I think I see that credit, affordable and convenient credit, is the killer app of making a country cashless. And I think that benefit will start overriding everything else. But having said that, you know, this is not a one-year kind of a project. This is a project that will run over decades. I still believe it'll be many, many years before we go to truly cashless in a large country and, you know, disparate country like India with 1 billion people, whereas certainly in a smaller country like Sweden or Estonia, which has just a few million people, which are highly homogeneous and well-educated, they can probably do the transition much faster.
According to a recent report by the Boston Consulting Group and Google, In developed countries, cash contributed to just 20 to 25% of overall consumer payments. In India, that number was 78%. And then, in late 2016, something radical happened. At 10:15 p.m. India Standard Time on November 8th, Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced that at the stroke of midnight, all 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, worth about 7.5 and 15 US dollars respectively, were being recalled and would cease to be legal tender. People had just 50 days to redeem their old notes for new ones or deposit their cash in bank accounts. Modi argued that cash was too often being used to avoid taxes, that it drove the black market, financed terrorism. This audacious move caused more than a little bit of chaos. Some vital industries were damaged by the cash grab, and many black marketeers were able to launder their cash despite the safeguards Modi put in place. But in the long term, it may be just the thing to boost India's digital economy and solve the big problems that Modi was hoping to solve. That said, cash is such an entrenched piece of modern society that even if you're intellectually in favor of going cashless, it can be hard, psychically, to commit. Consider Sweden, which seems to be winning the race to a cashless future. Even Sweden has its reservations. Niklas Arvidsson again.
We made a study about 2 years ago with, we interviewed 1,000 Swedes that were a representative sample of the entire population of Sweden. And there, two-thirds said that they think cash is a human right. So there was a very strong sentimental feeling towards cash. It is a human right to access cash, while at the same time we see that no one is, or fewer and fewer and very few today, are using cash. Yeah, this is an interesting paradox. I think there's something related to that cash is a symbol of the state of Sweden, and people like that. We like when the national team in ice hockey or football play the games, we feel like Swedes. And it seems like it's the same with cash. We feel like Swedes when we see Swedish cash, even though we do not use it.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, does the decline of cash inherently mean the rise of math-based currencies like Bitcoin?
What's really revolutionary, I think, about the whole math-based currency movement is that people have figured out a way that I can send an item of value from one entity to another entity securely, almost instantly, and without a middleman.
But Bitcoin can't solve all of cash's problems, not yet at least.
They gave the example of it's very hard to transport $1 million in hard currency overseas. You can't just put it in a backpack and get on a plane very easily. But it is very easy to do that now digitally using Bitcoin.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
It strikes me that the world is currently divided into two groups of people. Those who care a great deal about Bitcoin and either love it or hate it, and those who couldn't care less. Now, the second group is large, but the first group is noisy. And as a result, you've been hearing a great deal about Bitcoin in the media. You've heard that it's a digital currency, a cryptocurrency technically, whose price has risen from about 5 cents per Bitcoin to much, much higher than that.
The value of Bitcoin skyrocketed to a new record of $900 today.
You've heard that Bitcoin was launched in 2009 after a white paper on the topic was published a year earlier by a secretive person or perhaps group of people who go by the name Satoshi Nakamoto. You may have also heard that only 21 million Bitcoins will ever be circulated and that each coin is created by a form of mining in which a powerful computer has to solve hard math problems.
And so the mining basically was a way to rig into the protocol a systematic way to distribute the currency. So you're not worried that, say, somebody's going to have a whole lot of Bitcoins and flood the market overnight, which could then cause your Bitcoin to be worth less.
You may have even heard people call this mining wasteful.
So it's just burning a lot of electricity, enough to power, you know, many, many homes. I've heard estimates as high as 3 million homes could be powered with the electricity that goes to Bitcoin mining.
You've probably heard that Bitcoin has enemies in high places.
A Chinese government crackdown on domestic trading of the virtual currency Bitcoin is starting to have an effect.
You may have heard that alleged criminals like Bitcoin.
The CEO of one of the world's leading Bitcoin exchanges, BitInstant, has been arrested in New York. The prosecution claims Charlie Shrem was involved in a drug money laundering scheme via the Silk Road website.
And you definitely heard about the biggest heist in digital currency history.
It was only virtual money, but it is gone. The largest Bitcoin exchange declared bankruptcy in Japan today. The Mt. Gox online exchange, based in Japan, was hacked out of 850,000 coins of the virtual currency earlier this week, valued at near $500 million.
This incident produced headlines declaring that the Bitcoin revolution is over. The skeptics say, thank God, what took so long? While the boosters say, you're kidding, over? The Bitcoin revolution hasn't even begun yet.
One way to look at it is basically Mt. Gox has to fail for Bitcoin to be able to go mainstream, because Mt. Gox was never set up to be able to take Bitcoin mainstream, which is what's basically happening now.
Just say your name and what you do, and since you've done so much that's so amazing, feel free to brag. Don't be, you know, super shy, okay?
You know, I'm from the Midwest, and so we really don't do that.
Do your best. At least say, will you say your name at least?
I will. I'll admit to that much. So my name is Mark Andreessen. In a former life, I was an inventor, an entrepreneur, and more recently, I've become a professional venture capitalist.
Andreessen's firm has invested around $60 million in two Bitcoin-related companies. One of them is Coinbase, a Bitcoin exchange and transaction service that is a rival to the now-defunct Mt. Gox. So Andreessen has, quite literally, a vested interest in Bitcoin.
You say vested interest, I say skin in the game.
Okay, fair enough.
Is there money where my mouth is, but we'll have that debate another day.
So what gets someone like Andreessen so excited about Bitcoin?
At the core of what Bitcoin is the solution to a fundamental problem in computer science that's been around for decades that had never been solved before.
Now, if you're not a fan of computer science, this might get a little bit less interesting before it gets more interesting, but hang in there. The problem Bitcoin solved, says Andreessen, was known as the Byzantine General's problem.
The metaphor basically is you have a group of generals in the Byzantine Empire, and they've surrounded a huge city, and there's these encampments that these generals have all the way around the city, and at some point they're going to lay siege to the city. But they have the coordination problem, which is they have to be able to communicate with each other to develop the battle plan and to decide when to launch the attack. And so they're sending runners back and forth between the cities. The twist to it is some of the generals are traitors, but none of the other generals know which ones are traitors. And so the question is, how do you coordinate a significant number of people who don't know each other and don't trust each other being able to communicate securely and be able to basically establish digital trust? And as you're probably well aware, digital trust is a concept that's brand new. Like, you know, one of the huge problems of the internet over 20 years is who do you trust? You know, which websites do you trust? Which people do you trust when you do a transaction? Who do you trust? And so this idea of the Byzantine generals problem turns out to apply directly to the internet as a whole. One of the things as a consequence that's been missing on the internet for 20 years is kind of a native concept of money, right? And so the ability to very easily pay somebody online, the ability to very easily charge for a piece of content, the ability to very easily exchange a digital title or a digital key or a digital contract, that's just been missing because you have no mechanism for establishing trust. And so Bitcoin basically holds out the promise of being the first solution to establishing trust over an untrusted network.
Now, you may be thinking, wait a minute, I've been using the internet for years to pay people online, carry out all kinds of transactions. There's already a huge e-commerce infrastructure. Isn't this what banks and credit card companies already do?
What's really revolutionary, I think, about the whole math-based currency movement is that people have figured out a way that I can send an item of value from one entity to another entity securely, almost instantly, and without a middleman.
That's Susan Athey. She's an economist at Stanford. She also studied computer science. And she's an advisor to Ripple, another virtual currency, which is a Bitcoin rival. Until now, middlemen were necessary to fight what is called the double spending problem. Let's say you download this radio program, and then you send a copy to a friend. Now you each have a digital copy. That's nice, but in the case of digital money, that would not be so nice. You are not supposed to be able to spend your money and keep it too. Now, to avoid this, we've relied up till now on a middleman, like a credit card company or PayPal. What they do is essentially transfer IOUs back and forth to make sure that digital money is not spent twice.
The beauty of a new currency, which is part of a virtual currency protocol, is that what I'm moving from me to you is just an entry on a secure public ledger. And that public ledger is maintained by a set of computers all talking to each other using a protocol. So I don't have to worry about some bank giving me an IOU and then taking that IOU and handing it to another bank. Instead, if I make a transaction over the virtual currency, it's just an entry in the ledger. So I don't need a middleman.
Without us knowing each other ahead of time, I can send you a unique piece of digital property that might be digital cash or a digital key or a digital contract.
That's Mark Andreessen again.
It's a unique piece of digital property. I can send it to you. What then happens is the network basically validates the transaction. And after the transaction is validated, everybody else in the network is able to inspect that transaction and they're able to confirm that I originally owned that piece of property and now you originally own that piece of property. And I didn't transfer it to three other people at the same time. I didn't lie about the fact that I transferred it. You didn't lie about the fact that you now own it. And basically, everybody can inspect this blockchain anytime they want, and they can basically prove through the math of Bitcoin that that transaction actually took place. And that's kind of the magic to the system.
The blockchain that Andreessen just mentioned is what Susan Athey was describing earlier as a public ledger. It is a log of all transactions in the Bitcoin ecosystem. Now, banks and other financial institutions already have ledgers of their own, which let them transfer funds internally or with other trusted parties. But now, it seems, Bitcoin's blockchain technology could do this without the middleman, which means faster and cheaper.
And that actually opens up all sorts of economic possibilities, some of which we can talk about, but some that we probably haven't even imagined yet.
Okay, what sort of economic possibilities does that open up? Well, if you're in the retail, banking, or credit card industry, mostly bad possibilities. Those industries have made fortunes by taking a cut of every transaction, which a virtual and virtually frictionless currency like Bitcoin could perform for much, much less. Now, what's the big deal about that? What kind of markets might benefit?
One is the remittance market. So, you know, we have poor people from developing countries go abroad and then they remit their money back home to the home country to feed their children or their parents and their families. And the fees can be, you know, around 10%.
Mark Andreessen, not surprisingly, sees a lot of potential upsides too.
Some of that business will be transactions. Some of that business will be digital contracts. Some of that business will be digital keys, digital signatures. And then a system will start to work itself into things like anti-fraud or things like public payments or things like micropayments.
Wait a minute. Anti-fraud? Aren't banks and credit card companies already pretty good at anti-fraud?
Well, credit card fraud, we actually know basically what credit card fraud costs the economy, which is it's basically most of the credit card fees. And so, you know, economy-wide across all credit card transactions, you know, credit card fees range, you know, basically between 2 and 3%. The majority of that is paying for fraud. And so one way to think about credit card fraud is a 2 to 3% drag on the entire economy. It's an artifact of the fact that credit cards were never designed to be used the way that they're being used today. Credit cards never anticipated online transactions. Credit cards, by the way, the credit card system never anticipated malware running inside a cash register at Target, right? I mean, that
right.
was in the 1950s, that was an inconceivable idea, which is when credit cards were dreamed up. And so if you have a payment system like Bitcoin where you don't have the credential exchange and you have no risk of identity fraud and you have no risk of people being able to run transactions on your credit card after the fact, you could basically eliminate that entire category of fraud.
So what are the advantages of a currency and or transaction platform that is not affiliated in any way with a government?
So there are people who will tell you that's a really, really big deal. Like I think in the U.S., you know, with certain exceptions like 2008, you know, generally in the West and the U.S., we're blessed with a fairly stable financial system, with a fairly stable monetary system, with a fairly stable government. You know, we complain about our government all the time, but like it works pretty well. I think the benefit to Bitcoin not being connected to a government is much greater in poorly run countries. And, you know, you go all over the planet. Once you get outside of the U.S., there's like, you know, 150 countries that have what we would consider to be subpar governance. Right. And so typically they have, you know, corrupt governments. And then you also have a lot of countries that have very badly run banking systems and very badly run central banks. And so I think in a lot of the rest of the world, outside the U.S., outside of Western Europe, there is a fair amount of demand from people to be able to do things that we take for granted, like being able to exchange money without it getting stolen, or to be able to store money someplace where, you know, the central bank can't just hyperinflate it.
So you can see why Marc Andreessen is such an evangelist for Bitcoin, aside from the fact that his firm has Bitcoin investments. But what about the Mt. Gox exchange getting hacked to death to the tune of several hundred million dollars? What about the potential criminal uses of a virtual currency? It always comes back to the gangsters, even though gangsters have always done pretty well with cash, as have tax evaders. But still, you can see how a virtual currency like Bitcoin could alarm not only the banks and credit card companies whose fees might get hit, but regulators and lawmakers. Like Benjamin Lawski. He used to run the Department of Financial Services for New York State. He now runs his own financial advisory firm and is a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Cyber Initiative.
Look, I think I'm both concerned, worried, and excited about Bitcoin. I think it has potentially a bright future to it. And it could really potentially, at least the technology, could revolutionize or at least improve upon our existing payment systems. And I think we're in a period where we're going to have just a lot of change over the next 5 to 10 years in mobile payments and how we, you know, the collision between the traditional banking sector and technology.
Lawski recently organized a 2-day fact-finding mission to help his office write some of the first Bitcoin regulation in the United States. So, what did he learn?
It holds a lot of potential, and as we design this regulatory scheme for Bitcoin, for virtual currencies, we want to make sure we are setting rules of the road that enable innovation to continue, that allow the sort of positives, the potential really interesting future that Bitcoin can have as a way for people especially to engage in international transactions to happen and to happen efficiently. But at the same time, we learned, and I think the law enforcement panel was very clear on this, that there are very unique, tough challenges for law enforcement when it comes to virtual currencies. They gave the example of it's very hard to transport $1 million in hard currency overseas. You can't just put it in a backpack and get on a plane very easily. But it is very easy to do that now digitally using Bitcoin. And with the uses of other technologies that there was testimony about, things like what are called tumblers that make people even more anonymous, it's become a real hurdle sometimes for law enforcement to try and track down who is engaging in some of these transactions.
Lawski, like the economist Susan Athey, thinks Bitcoin could reshape the remittance market.
Right now, there are thousands and thousands of New Yorkers who work very hard every day to send money back home to their families in whatever country they're from. And right now, they're paying fees for those wire transactions each week at the end of the week, 7, 8, 9%. And that's a lot of money for people who often can't afford it.
And Lawski heard about potential uses that he hadn't even imagined.
There was some testimony about how one of the potential advantages of Bitcoin as a currency was that it was programmable. It was a programmable currency. And I didn't really understand that. And I asked a couple different panels what that meant and could they expand upon it. And the first day, one of the gentlemen answered and said, well, you can, for example, color code. And that's not literally, but in the technology, the Bitcoins you're using to have them perform certain functions. You know, it's code as well. And he said at one point, he said, you know, you could be coding it in such a way that you would be paying for transactions and at the same time, the code could be working on a cure for cancer. And that, again, I'm still trying to get my mind around that. I'm not sure I fully understand that. But I think there is clearly a kernel of very interesting computer programming innovation that's built into virtual currency that holds a lot of promise.
That's fascinating. You know, when you said color coding, where my mind jumped to, and I'm just curious what you'd say about this, you know, let's pretend that the U.S. government wants to give $10 million to some country to feed its people on Wednesday, and the money shows up in cash on Thursday. Well, that cash can go to buy anything, obviously. Cash is fungible, and that's what we love about it. That's what's great about it. But on the other hand, if I could color code that Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies so that it can be used actually to buy food and wheat and soy and so on and not rocket launchers, well, that's a great piece of – that's a great ability for me to have in a currency that acts like cash, yeah?
Yes, and I think my understanding, and it was really from the day two testimony when I asked that question again about programmable currency, that that is one of the things that potentially you could have with the color coding. They also gave an example of a young person whose parents want to give them an allowance, but want to make sure it goes for certain things and not other things. You could program it in certain ways that would do that.
I have to say, I was surprised, a little bit excited too, I guess, to hear Benjamin Lawski talk about how excited he is about the future uses of Bitcoin, or something like it. It's quite unlike the view taken by Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Bitcoin, Dr. Greenspan, Bitcoin has been on a tear, up 80-fold this year. What are your thoughts on this? Is Bitcoin, in fact, a bubble?
I guess so. I mean, let me say that currencies to be exchangeable have to be backed by something. When we're on the gold standard, gold and silver had intrinsic value.
Could it be the new gold? Not really backed by anything?
Mm-hmm. No, it has to have intrinsic value. You have to really stretch your imagination to infer what the intrinsic value of Bitcoin is. If you ask me, is this a bubble in Bitcoin? Yeah, it's a bubble.
So there's a number of top economists who have basically taken positions like that.
That's Mark Andreessen again.
It's a little bit like dogs watching TV. It's like, it's all very interesting, but like whatever until another dog shows up on screen and then the dog freaks out.
Uh-huh.
Economists, like this stuff is all like whatever, technology, geek, nerds, whatever. And then currency is the flag, right? And so the minute the word currency shows up, like all the economists perk up. Because if there's one thing the economists are all experts on, it's currency. And they think they look at it and then they're like, oh my God, people are paying $600 for this thing. It's just a piece of fake digital currency. Like people have just completely lost their minds. I don't think that they are looking at the underlying substance.
It is the underlying substance, the underlying capability of this new technology that excites people like Andreessen. Maybe it excites you too. But odds are, you haven't heard much or thought much about that technology. What you have heard about is this runaway, inflationary, possibly criminal, subject to hacking, weirdo, anarchist cryptocurrency. And it has you confounded, maybe even frightened. If it makes you feel any better, that's how a lot of people were feeling a few centuries ago when another transactional technology hit the market.
One of the characteristics of a new idea is all the experts who came up in the sort of old regime look at it and laugh. By the way, the exact same thing happened with paper currency 300 years ago. Almost exactly 300 years ago, a Scottish economist, ironically named John Law, basically invented this, at the time, crazy idea of paper currency or fiat currency. And actually, he was laughed out of Scotland. He was laughed out of the UK. And he was laughed actually all the way to France, where he became the French finance minister for King Louis XV. And every economist on the planet 300 years ago thought that he was a complete lunatic. And so I think this is just, this is the story. This is kind of the recurring story of how progress happens. It doesn't happen by the establishment all basically sitting up at once and saying, aha, that's a wonderful idea. Like, that's just not how it happens.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.